Hello and welcome to The Leap of Faith. Our guest this evening brought her passion as an amateur historian to bear on a local story that has since come to global attention. Her research revealed death certificates for 796 children at the two mother and baby home from 1925 to 1961, with no indication of where they'd been buried. Last year, the Mother and Baby Home's Commission of Investigation confirmed the discovery of juvenile human remains in significant quantities in the chambers at the former home run by Bonsecours nuns. Earlier today, the remarkable woman who carried out this painstaking research was conferred with an honorary doctorate by Trinity College in Dublin. Catherine Corliss, welcome to The Leap of Faith. Catherine, we're talking to you on the occasion of you receiving an honorary doctorate, but there does seem to be an irony in the fact that when you started out doing this research as an unofficial historian, getting access to any information was far from easy for you.
That's correct, Michael, yes. From right from the start, there was a brick wall against me everywhere I went. So it is quite ironic that Trinity College are offering me a doctorate in law. And it is a huge honour, not alone for me, but for what I stand for. It's an honour for all the survivors whom I've been helping, and especially for the babies who were buried and discarded so recklessly in a sewage area in Tuam. And that has been the focus of my research. And I am so happy on behalf of them, because it makes a huge statement that my research is important. It was important to research the babies and how they were buried. And it's a huge honour for me to receive that doctorate in law.
Take us back a little, if you would, to how you found yourself doing this in the very first place. What made you sit down and decide, OK, here's the direction I want to go?
The Old Tuam Society, they bring out an annual every year called JOTS, the Journal of the Old Tuam Society. And the editor approached me and asked me, would I write an essay for this book? Well, I said, I'll try. So I wondered then, and I don't know, it just came out of nowhere that I would do an essay on the home in Tuam. Now, I did remember the old building because I lived out that way, and we'd walk in and out of school from the country, the 2.5 miles, and we would be walking past this 10-foot high wall, and we just knew there was an orphanage or something in there. And as a child in school, I remember that. So I decided, hold on, that home was knocked in the 1970s to make way for a housing estate. So I decided then just to do my research on the mother and baby home in Tuam and a bit of history on the Bonsecours sisters. But first of all, I tried in the local library and I found very little information on the mother and baby home, which I was very surprised at. And then I went to the Bonsecours sisters themselves and I asked them, had they any records or anything like that, that I wanted to do an essay on the home in Tuam. And they said they had absolutely nothing for me, because they said they handed everything they had when they left Tuam in 1961, when the home closed, that they left it to the Western Health Board. So then I go to the Western Health Board and I ask them for records, and they said no, they handed everything over to the Galway County Council. So between the lot of them, I was getting very, very little. So I approached the area of where the mother and baby home stood on the Dublin Road in Tuam. There's a housing estate there now. And I just went to them to ask them, had they any memories of the children growing up there, or just anything behind those 10-foot high walls. Now, the residents there knew very little because they had only moved in the 1970s. But there's an older housing estate that was built in the 1930s on the Athenry Road and the Tubbajareth Road. And it was mainly from asking people from the older estate. And they gave me some stories of children roaring and crying, and they could see into the over the high walls from their top windows. And they spoke of, I got different stories of children being beaten regularly on the they could see it from outside. And they spoke about the children walking up and down to school with they had these big clogs, you could hear them all over the place, that they wore. It was like an army marching. They all remembered the children walking in their clogs and the clatter of their feet. And they told me as well that they always came in later to school and they left earlier again in the evening. I think the idea was to isolate them from the rest of the classroom and so the children wouldn't be playing together. So I got those snippets of information and I was building a story then.
So you're hearing some stories through word of mouth in the area, but then came one account with some information which you'd never come across before, and it was very disturbing. Tell us about that.
When I was just walking around the estate, the Dublin Roadhousing estate, I was talking to a few of the residents there, but they told me a story I had never heard before. They said that the housing estate is built in the 7 acres of where the home stood. And within that 7 acres, there's a huge, very large playground. But in the corner of that playground, there was a place cordoned off, and it was kept lovely with shrubs and flowers and well-kept lawn. I suppose it would be about just like a large garden. So they told me this story about that there's children buried there in that area. I had never heard that before, because there was nothing to tell you it was a graveyard. And I asked them about that, and they recounted this story of back in 1975, when the housing estate was nearly finished, that two local boys were playing in the area, and they came across what they thought was a crypt in the burial crypt in that corner. They said the boys found a big slab in the ground, and it was more or less cracked. And they opened it, and they were shocked and horrified to see. When they looked down, there seemed to be a sort of a chamber of little skulls and bones all mingled. And they got the fright of their lives. And of course, the parents were told. After that, the guards came up. They said they were belonging to the famine area, because before the mother and baby home was opened in 1925, it had been a workhouse since the 1840. And there were famine burials in further areas afield in that 7 acres. And they assumed that these bones would have belonged to the people of the famine. And so after that, then, the guards came up and said there were famine bones. The Bouncecourt sisters were informed, because they had been on that site, and they said they knew nothing about it. And a priest came up then and just said a few prayers over where the spot where the boys found the bones. And the county council came in then and added rubble and clay and covered it all up and levelled off the area. And from then on, the locals, because all they thought they were famine, little famine babies, and it was just covered up. And somebody added a little cross to the area and put up a little plaque to say that they're just saying, have mercy on the people buried here. So it was all nicely covered up and grand, and there were the famine victims, and the local people in their goodness kept the area just in honour of them. So then just another person then just kind of said to me that they're not all famine victims, if they are famine victims at all. There's home babies buried there. And I was horrified at that. Okay, bad enough having famine victims from way back when Ireland was in dire poverty and people were buried everywhere, we know that. But the idea that that the Bouncecourt sisters were in charge of this place, and that there could be possibly children who died in the home just buried there, and it's not accounted for as a graveyard, and it's not there's no sign of it being a graveyard. So that's really when I started to dig deeper into my research.
But at this point, apart from anecdotal accounts, you had little to go on. And of course, who could ever have imagined what would eventually be uncovered? How did you begin to gather more concrete evidence?
Firstly, I had to find out, okay, if someone thinks there's home babies buried there, I had to find out how many died in the home. Again, I went to the Bouncecourts and they had no records. Same story, nobody had any records of anything, anywhere. So, okay, I just thought then, I said, hold on, the births, deaths, marriages, they're open records, I can access those. So I went to Galway, births, deaths, marriages, and had a chat with them there. And I would have loved to have gone in myself and done some research, but they weren't allowing the public in anymore because it's only a small area. And what they said, give us a few weeks, we'll do the research for you, and you can buy the records. So a very nice girl called Anne Glennon, who has been an enormous help to me over the years. Nothing is any problem to her when I ask questions or look for something. She said, give me a few weeks, I'll come back to you. And she did. And she rang me and she said, do you really want to purchase all those death certs? She said, I have the list of children who died in the home. Now, I was expecting maybe 50, 60. Even that would be enormous. She said, there are hundreds of deaths between 1925 and 1961. So I said, I want each and every one of them. So what they did, they made a deal with me. They said, we'll give you an Excel printout, because it would have been an enormous cost to buy the whole lot. I said, I need to buy so much. So I bought about 100, and they put the rest, they put along with the Excel sheet. But so they gave me the deaths of the children, their names, the age that they died, where they died, and what they died of. Now I have 796 death certs. Their names, where they came from, their ages, and cause of death. Now I was absolutely horrified and staggered to think that all those children died in the home. Then of course I had to go on and find out, were any of those children brought home to their families and buried elsewhere? So with the help of Galway County Council archivist Patria McWalter, she checked her digitalised account of whatever graveyard books that she had left in to the library. She had digitised quite a lot of them. I gave her my list and she went through what the books that she had, and she could not find one name of the 796 of the children that were buried. No record in any of the graveyard books around County Galway, Mayo. So I had to go to some, I had to check in Mayo as well then. So with the result, okay, I could not find any, at the time, I could not find any burial account of a child that would have been buried anywhere. So the conclusion was, of course, 796 children, no burial records, where can they be? And the consensus was they had to be buried on the grounds of the mother and baby home. So then I just wondered, what would the sisters have made a crypt or something then in that area where the boys found the bones? So I researched that then, and when I studied old maps, I had all this information from my local history course on where to look and how to find things. So I went and found an Ordnance Survey map from when the home had opened around that era, and for the workhouse I had maps from the times of the 1840s right up to the 1920s. So when I studied the maps, I found that where the boys had found the bones, which was in this supposedly crypt, I was horrified to see that the exact spot where the boys pointed to where to finding the bones, it was actually a working sewage tank in the time of the workhouse. Now it's very easy pinpointed exactly, because this special area where the bones were found, it's not aligned with the 7 acres. It kind of juts out into a corner of its own. So it's very easy pinpointed on the map. So exactly where the boys found the bones, it tells me in black ink, in black printed ink, this was a sewage tank. So the horrific thought that the babies who died in the Tuam home, now they were between infants right up to 3 years, that could they possibly be discarded in that fashion, and the sewage tank turned into a sort of crypt. Now that was horrific in my eyes, and I just had to keep on my research, and I got into it more intensely at that stage.
Catherine, understanding why children were dealt with as they were, I mean, 4 years later, since I think you met with the Bon Secours, have you any extra insight?
I have no insight whatsoever. I can only assume and presume what happened. Well, first of all, the speculation was, and my research was misinterpreted, that the nuns threw the babies into a raw sewage tank. Now, that was just ridiculous. In the first place, I know they wouldn't do that. And secondly, it would block up the whole system. It didn't make sense one way or the other. It wouldn't have been practical. What happened was, I found out again through more research and through actually looking through all newspapers, the Tuam Herald particularly, it gave an account of that sewage tank back in the time of the workhouse. It was given an awful lot of trouble. They did a lot with it, and there's a fair account of what they had to, how they had to work that sewage tank to get it, you know, to stop it overflowing. And then come forward to the 1930s. In 1937, I got an account in the Old Tuam Herald that this sewage tank became defunct because a new sewage system came into the Tuam area and it went right up to the mother and baby home. It mentions that in an account in the Tuam Herald that the Tuam home, they joined up with the main Tuam system. So all this underground system of sewage tanks became defunct. Now we're talking about a Victorian system that was put there when the workhouse was built. It's a massive system of massive brick tanks, not like the ones we have today. And there were tunnels you could walk through leading to them, because I suppose they had to be emptied out every now and then. And that was the idea of that. And the effluent was used as fertiliser for farmers. So you could go down through these tunnels, which would reach into the sewage tank. That's kind of a sewage system we're talking about. So it was obvious to me that maybe in the ninth, that well, it's not, there's no maybe now, it's been proved that after these, this whole underground system became defunct, you had a large, massive sewage tank. It became an ideal burial chamber in their minds, I suppose. But what really got me was these are illegitimate children. They were frowned on. Some people called them the devil spawn. They were beautiful, innocent, beautiful toddlers, children up to 3 years. They died in dire circumstances. There was an awful lot of neglect there. The papers also speculated that they were let die. I don't know about that. But what I do know is there was massive, huge neglect. Not enough food. Just neglect, not enough medicine. And there were just, maybe a lot of them were just, if they were weak, they were just let die. But to discard of them that way, it was just the final kick, I suppose, that they were frowned upon in life. They were treated badly. And these babies were dying, and the nuns didn't say anything wrong with burying them quietly, secretly, down underground in a disused sewage tank. It was just the final insult to the mothers and to babies.
Catherine, what has this done to your faith?
Well, I haven't been to church, as I say, in a long, long time, and I don't intend going back, because since I was a child, I never really got the Catholic faith, what we were taught in school, what the nuns hammered into us, because I couldn't see. Even as a child, I could see they're preaching one thing, but they're not living it, and they should be. The best part of the Mass for me, I always went because of my own family, and of course my own parents went, and my own children growing up, I wanted to keep them in the tradition. And I always listened to the Gospels. I always loved the Gospels. I loved the message in the Gospels. But it became apparent to me that the Church are not living what they are preaching. Now, Pope Francis, when he was in Ireland, he more or less said that in so many words, to go back to the Gospels, the message of the Gospels. I don't know where along the centuries where arrogance and power came into it, because that is not in the Gospel of the Jesus that I became to know as a child. When I was a child, I was a bit of a loner, and I spent quite a lot of time walking the fields with my dogs. And I just got in tune with nature somehow, and that's where I found God. I found his presence with me no matter where I went, not locked away in a tabernacle, as they call it. People go to church, they adore a tabernacle. Now, even as a child, I couldn't understand that. I remember in school, probably fourth or fifth class, and the nun was telling us, the church was quite near the school, to go down after school and say a prayer to Jesus, because he was very lonely there in the tabernacle and the altar, and go down and say a prayer to him. Now, even at that age, I was confused, because when I'm out in the fields, God is with me. When I'm digging my garden, God is with me. When I'm with animals, when I'm with children, God is very much present. And I feel that the church have reduced the Jesus I know and love to, as Mary McAleese stated, a politician and a business person. I really wish the church would go back to the Gospels, to the simplicity. Even in Tuam, at the moment, there's a multi-million refurbishment going on for the church in Tuam. Now, I wrote to our local paper even about that, because I felt angry about that. Because I stated in my letter, and I'll state it again, is that what Jesus asked? Do we need all this ritual and grandiosity to get closer to God in prayer? That is putting people off going to the church. People are changing. They're getting the freedom to speak their own minds anymore and to speak their feelings. we should go back to the Gospels because the real message is there. And that's, you ask the question, have I lost my faith? My faith is in the Jesus who lives in nature and who lives amongst us. And that is the faith that I follow.
You've had some wonderful support through this whole process as well from Aidan, your husband.
Aidan has been fantastic. I mean to say, right from the start, when I showed him my research, and first of all, he said, I was doing it for the ESSA, and he said, they're never going to print that in Chum. But fair play to them, they did. I hadn't all this evidence at the time now. It was a lot, much more low key. But I did ask the question in my essay, is it possible that the Chum babies are buried in this old septic tank? And I was expecting maybe a huge reaction locally afterwards. But there was nothing. There was just a dead silence. Even when the story broke in 2014, there was just a silence from the church. I was asking the clergy just to, you know, were they going to do anything about this? But there was just total silence. Total silence from the Bon Secours, total silence from the authorities. They really wanted all this to go away. But going back to Aidan, your programme is called The Leap of Faith. It was a leap of faith for Aidan to believe what I was doing, to believe in me and the family as well, of four children, just to believe in me and just to back me and to help me every stage that they could. Now, Aidan has been really my huge support, not just driving me here, there and everywhere, being with me at meetings, being with me when I was going up to the government to speak with them. And not alone that, it's an emotional support, sort of a safety net for me. And he has been absolutely fantastic. And I would also like to say that the way things have turned out now, and that the remains have been discovered and they have been carbon dated to the mother and baby home in Chum. We know now these are the home babies and children that are buried in that tank. And the fact that Minister Zappone has been a great help to us as well. And now that they're going to be exhumed and DNA tested and hopefully reburied with the burial that they should have got in the first place, I would like to see as much as possible for them all to get a little white coffin. That's what they deserved right from the start. And we really hope to see that happening. It's not done and dusted yet because there's legislation going through. It's a legislation that isn't in place to allow mass exhumation. So hopefully that legislation will be put through and hopefully work will start next summer on exhuming the babies. I think it's very important because it's a huge statement to the survivors, the people who are born there, the people who have family there. It gives them more status, and it just, it's like Ireland saying to them, we are sorry, we acknowledge what happened and we are going to make reparation to you all. That is what I would like to see happen, and that is what I hope will happen, because those little babies, they were just as important. They could be alive today like the rest of us. They were just as important as any other baby that is born in Ireland, and I really hope to see that happening.
What was your reaction when you heard that Catherine Zappone had actually brought up the topic with Pope Francis?
I was absolutely shocked. It was Aidan that spotted her. She said, she's talking to the Pope. And fair play to her. I think she just had a quick word that she would be following up with the memo. And thing is, that, as far as I know, the Vatican haven't replied to her yet. And that again is where this arrogance and power comes in, that I feel that if right at the start, when I exposed my findings, it was a huge chance for the church to say, my goodness, we have to look into this. It was a chance for the Bon Secours to say, OK, we didn't do it, but our forebears did, the nuns that are gone on ahead of us, this is what they did. What can we do now? What can we do to help? What can we do for survivors? It was a chance for everyone to come out clean and just say, what will we do about this? But there wasn't. This silence goes on with the church, this protecting themselves. And they just have to realise that the truth matters, and that's all that matters, because everything else will fall into place if you just come out and tell the truth and just do something about the wrongdoings. That is the only way. That is the only way to healing for all those who have suffered so badly.
Are you aware of any commitment from the Bon Secours towards the cost of this exhumation?
Well, the only awareness I have is that Minister Zappone said that I think it's 2.5 million they're giving. Now, we all know they can't afford to cover the whole cost. And it would be a healing if they did. it would be a genuine healing for all the people that I'm meeting with, to show that they care enough, that it would show that they're acknowledging what happened. It would show that they're apologising. And it will be a chance for them to say that money doesn't matter, that we will make reparation to all those we have hurt. That would be the truth. That's what I would hope for.
There's a sad part of human nature, is that sometimes people turn on the messenger. Do you or Aidan ever worry about that for you?
I just put it at the back of my mind. I know I was lucky enough, I suppose, I got a fair bit of support from the people of the town. And many people came up to me and said, thanks for what you're doing. It needed to be done. Fair play to you, of great courage. Now, when I see people approach me, I just brace myself because I know it can be this way or that way. Now, it was mostly fair play, well done. And I know there's a lot being said online, but I choose to ignore people who are calling it all a hoax. They call me a typist, not a local, not a researcher. They call me a liar. They said this is all for my own glory. But it doesn't really matter to me. I don't look online anymore because, I know the truth, and that's all that matters. I know what I did. I did this for justice. I did it for the forgotten people. And that's all that matters in my mind. I just probably feel because of my faith, I almost felt at times that those babies were calling out to me. They came to me in dreams even. And I just kept following. I asked God for help in my own way. I would ask him up in the fields when I'd be walking with the dog. And all I would say was, speak, Lord, your servant is listening. I found that a very powerful prayer. Just empty your mind and just to ask God, just what will I do next? And that is my prayer. And that I leaned on that and things just fell into place for me after that. Because I'm not doing it for myself. I'm doing it for justice and truth.
Dr. Catherine Gorlis, thank you for joining us on The Leap of Faith.
Thank you.
And that's The Leap of Faith for this week. Do drop us an email with your comments to faith@rte.ie. From all of us here tonight, good night.